legislative assistant will take the role and will inform me of when we have a quorum so that we can officially start the meeting, but we will get going. We will be on time every time. We'll respect the time of the members, the staff, and the folks that come to testify on bills or to make statements to the committee. Normally at this time, then, we would be approving minutes. Since we have no minutes, we will go down to some committee introductions. What I'd like to do is go around. I think I'll wait a little bit, actually, for the committee introductions because we have some folks here that have not arrived yet. We're going to be making a bit of a change to the tax committee here in that, and it's a big change for me, we're actually going to have some committee rules. Previous chairs have done just fine without rules. Representative Lincheski did a great job chairing the committee with no rules. I went back and we couldn't find any rules. Well, you know, Krinke didn't have any rules. And then Abrams, and if you look back at the 8 years that I chaired committees, 6 years of commerce, 2 years at ag, of course, we never had any rules there. The reason, if you would look in your packet and take out the rules, basically what we're looking at is not that we need a whole bunch of rules. Most of us have been here before, know how to work in a committee. But they're just for basically for staff here to have a few rules here to get amendments in so members can see them early so that we can get them out to the public and so forth. That's the purpose. You'll notice the... one of the most important rules is when it says they're at the discretion of the chair. So that's a very important rule. So what we will do at this point, again, it's a great pleasure for me to be chairing the tax committee this year and in 2011-2012. I would like to make an announcement, and I wanted to have a little presentation for my good friend, Representative Sertich, who, as you know, will be resigning, I believe, January 13th to take on the head of the IRRRB, I believe, which he will do a very, very good job there. So I'm hoping he can be here Thursday in Tax Committee to say some goodbyes, and I have a little presentation that I'd like to make, or I'll probably have to go up to the range and make it up there. So what we're going to do today, I'm not a big one on backgrounds or those types of things, but I think... for this tax committee right now, with the number of freshmen that we have, and not just freshmen, but the number of new members we have to the committee, we need to go over some things. And we will find that we have some very, very important people here. And basically, that would be Mr. Joel Michaels' crew. And we want to introduce all of them so that we know who to go to get some tax questions answered. We have a great staff in house research. But, of course, the most important folks we'll start out with introducing are the committee pages. You will find that they are very, very important to the work of this committee, and they will be very busy this year as we move along throughout session. And if you could just raise your hand and maybe just say where you're from. Susie Murthen. Okay, welcome to the committee. Susie, we're glad you're here. Jenna Herring, Jenna?
I'm Jenna, and I'm from New Brighton, Minnesota.
New Brighton, Minnesota. And Travis? Where's Travis? He's doing some things for the committee already. Okay. We'll introduce Travis when he gets back. Now, what I'd like to do is go around the table. Before we go around the table, I want to introduce the House Research folks, and then we want to get everybody around the table that we can. But if we could start with the folks in the audience from House Research, just please stand up your name and what areas you cover.
Mr. Chair, Steve Hines from House Research, and I cover property taxes, especially property tax modeling and data analysis, and county aid.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, let's go with the rest of the House Research folks.
I'm Joel Michael, and I do corporate income, tax increment, the sort of the more minor taxes, the excise taxes like cigarettes, alcohol, Minnesota Care, and all the legal issues. And if you don't know who to call, you can always call me, and I'll send you to the right other person. Karen Baker would normally be here. She called me up about a half an hour ago. She's still caught in traffic. She does mainly property tax assessment issues and that sort of thing as well.
And I'm Pat Dalton. I do sales taxes, local sales taxes, local government aid, and levy limits.
Okay, thank you. And it's going to be quite a challenge for me as the chair to try to ask a question where I can stump Joel Michael. I spent 6 years as chair of the Commerce Committee, where during that 6 years, never once was I able to stump Tom Pender on a commerce issue, although in committee last year, I did actually have him have to turn around and grab a book and look at something. It was kind of exciting. Okay, I'd like to, at this point, Travis, if you could just say where you're from.
Shoreview,
and it's Travis Wozelik, and welcome to the committee. And so the three pages we've introduced here, or that have introduced themselves, will be invaluable to this committee, and we want to respect them and respect what they're doing here. So with that, let's just start out, Sandra, if we could start out with you and kind of go around just who you are, a little bit about your district, and then we'll go all the way around here and like that. Sandra.
Representative Sandra Erickson, District 16A, that is all of Mille Lacs County and parts of Sherburne, Benton, and Morrison, cities like Princeton, Foley, Malacca, Isle Onamia, and over to Piers. And, Mr. Chair, I would hope that we could simplify all of our tax codes.
Jim Dabney.
Good morning, Representative Jim Dabney. Represent part of South Minneapolis in my sixth term here. Hennepin County, the county I represent, is 25% of the state's population, provides 40% of the state's budget.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Tilbury from 51B, which is Fridley, Springlight Park, Moundsview, and a little bit of Blaine, and I'm starting my third term.
Okay, Representative Kuhn, before we go to you, I'll officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. We are in session today. Representative Kuhn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lyle Kuhn. I represent District 20B out in the prairie in western Minnesota. It includes Renville County, Eastern Yellow Medicine County, and Chippewa County. The county seats there would be Olivia, Granite Falls, and Montevideo. It's good to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ann Lincheski. I represent Bloomington.
And, excuse me, Representative Loeffler, Representative Lincheski, I believe, is the lead for the Democrats on this committee, and we're very happy for that.
Good morning. I'm Representative Diane Loeffler. I have the honor of representing the 13 neighborhoods of northeast Minneapolis. And I'm starting my fourth term.
Representative Loeffler, what's the geographic size of your district, would you say?
It will seem minuscule to many of you, but I think it's probably about 4 square miles, maybe 5. It's very compact. I have 7,700 rental buildings in my district, 5,000 of which are plexes, duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes. It's a wonderful area, thriving. We have industry. Yeah. We have tons of small businesses. Mm-hmm. We have some corporate 500 companies that have branches there, if not their headquarters. And I like it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you really want to find out the size of someone's district, ask them how many parades they attend each year. That'll really give you an idea of how big the district
19,
is.
19, Representative Marquardt.
You've got about 14, so okay. you're up okay. on me there. But Representative Paul Marquardt, this is my sixth term. I represent much of the area along the Red River Valley, all or parts of Wilkin, Traverse, Clay, and Becker County. So, and it's good to be here.
Glad you're here.
Representative Melissa Hortman from Brooklyn Park. I represent Northern Brooklyn Park and Southern Spring Rapids.
Representative Kurt Bills. I represent 37B, which is Rosemount and Apple Valley.
Stephen Rubis, GOP Research.
Bobby Patrick. I'm Committee Administrator for Taxes.
Jennifer Niska, CLA for Taxes.
Linda Runback, representing 53A, Shoreview, Lana Lakes, North Oaks, and Circle Pine is my home. And I have two parades.
Representative Runback, by the way, will be the chair of the Property Tax Division. So any bills that we have coming in that have any property tax implications will go down to Representative Run, not down. Sorry, over.
We know what you mean, Representative.
They're going way down to Representative Runbeck, and we'll go from that.
Steve Driskowski, District 28B, southeastern Minnesota, southern parts of Goodhue and Wabasha County, northern Winona County, and Mr. Chair, I'm at a deficiency, 11 parades.
Representative Connie Depke, I represent 33B, which is the Lake Minnetonka area. I have 11 towns that I represent and 3 parades. And I'm not going Hollywood, by the way. I already said this in my education committee. I did have some eye surgery, and so I'm sensitive to light, and I'm hoping to get these things off in about a week or so.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
I was wondering, I wanted a pair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Keith Downey, District 41A, which is most of Edina, and that is the prairie just east of Eden Prairie.
Representative Steve Gottwald, representing District 15A, which is St. Cloud, Way Park, St. Augustine, Rockville, up in Minnesota's heartland, and I've got 5 parades.
Mr. Chairman, Roger Crawford, I'm in 8B, which is Southern Pine County, Sandstone, Hinckley, Pine City, all of Kanabic County, which is Mora, Ogilvie, and a part of Isani County, Braham. Thank you.
My name is Mary Kiffmeyer, and I represent the heart of Sherburne County, which includes the cities of Becker, Big Lake, and Zimmerman and Clear Lake, and many townships as well. So often we name the cities. There are a lot of townships in Minnesota, and so I'm also very pleased to represent many townships and 3 parades.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Pam Myra. I represent House District 40A, which is northern, central, and western Burnsville, the downtown area of Savage, and I have 2 parades.
Mr. Chair members, my name is Doug Wardlow, and it's my first term, and I'm privileged to represent my hometown of Eagan, or rather, my home half of my hometown. It's roughly the eastern half and a little bit of the southern middle portion of Eagan.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I am Tara Mack. I represent District 37A, which is parts of Burnsville and the western half of Apple Valley.
I'm Sarah Anderson. I represent Plymouth and Medicine Lake.
I'm Michael Paymar. I'm in my 8th term from St. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kate Knuth. I represent New Brighton, Arden Hills, and part of Shoreview and Fridley.
We don't do that.
You will maybe note my district because we have one of the largest tracts of developable land in the metro area with the Twin Cities Army Ammunition Plant site. And so you may be hearing more about that this year. It's sort of an ongoing issue in our area. and hopefully one we can get a good resolution for this year or in the next few years.
Ambitious.
I'm John Lesh. I represent St. Paul, North End, East Side, Como Park. And the Rice Street Parade extends 4 blocks into my district, so I have half a parade.
We have some very unique parades in my district. One of them is the Wayland, Minnesota Town of 67, the Wayland Standstill Parade. They're geographically challenged because there's a bluff right at the end of town here, so you really can't go anywhere. So it's a standstill parade where all the units are there, and then the people that come to the parade walk around. It's very creative. Hey, you do what you got to do sometimes. Okay, a couple of things here. The district I represent is District 31B, Fillmore and Houston counties. I border Iowa and Wisconsin, so I'm way down there in the corner. A little bit about the agenda coming up before we get into a presentation from House Research. As my 8 previous years as chair, one thing that I always did was I always heard a DFL bill first. So what we're working on is a Mahoney bill regarding some bioscience issues, some tax issues. That'll be the first bill heard. And they are bills that we have reviewed and that they're not bills just to hear and just, we want to get them passed, some of those bills passed and to the governor's office. Also, I believe by February 15th, it's the charge of the governor to have his budget proposal ready. We will, in the tax committee, give that a full and fair hearing on his budget. And also, when it comes to this committee, I just can't think of this as a tax committee or even call it that. So it's really not a tax committee. It's an adventure. is what it will be. We're going to have a great committee. We've got some great members of this committee, and I think, well, I know that we all, as committee members, want what's best for this great state, what's best for the state of Minnesota. It's how we get there is where we will, I'm sure, have a lively debate along the way, and I'm looking forward to that. So with that, what I'd like to do at this time is introduce Joel Michaels and basically turn it over to Joel, and they have a presentation. Do you have a PowerPoint, Mr. Michael?
Yes.
And so we'll turn it over to Mr. Michael, and then he will introduce some of the members of House Research. And again, for new members of the committee here and all members, I hope you pay very close attention, because these are the folks that really know what's going on, can be very, very helpful to us. Representative Chesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we spoke briefly before the committee started, and you had mentioned an intention to talk about the committee rules today. Is that still your intention? Will you do that at the end, or?
Well, I think what we'll do is if it'd be okay to postpone that until possibly the next meeting, where we can actually sit down and go through them and any questions you have. I'd like to get some a presentation going here, if that's okay.
Sure.
With you, and we will visit in the meantime too about some various issues here too. So, but if we could defer that till then, we'll have a full discussion of the rules and how they'll work for everyone. We want to make them work so that we have an efficiently run committee here. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just introduce myself again, Joel Michael from House Research. What we're going to do today is to try to relatively quickly do an overview of the state taxes, not property taxes or aids. That'll be on Thursday. There are three, before we actually get into the substance, just I'd like to do a couple of things, and then Cynthia and Nina will take over. In relative to the House Research and House Fiscal staff, in your packet you have a handout that's a two-sided handout that looks like this on one side and that on the other, that has our names and our phone numbers and what we're responsible for on one side. On the other side, it's arranged by subject area. So that's the way you can sort of figure out who to call. But again, if you don't know who to call, call me or call anybody that you're comfortable with calling on the list, and we'll tell you who to talk to. Secondly, in the handout, you have a copy of the PowerPoint that we'll go through. And then thirdly, there's a longer document. I don't even look at how long. It's about 64 pages that has a lot more detail if you want to read about, you know, more background on some of the taxes that we're talking about, because this is going to be a 20,000-foot overview of most of these things. But the second thing I want to say before we get into this is that there are a bunch of written resources that are very useful to us and to you as members of the committee, sort of the tools of our trade, stuff that the Department of Revenue does, all of which is on the Department of Revenue's website, but I have hard copies here so that you can see what they are. For example, the tax incidence study, which looks like this, that probably many of you are familiar with. There will be a new one coming out in March. This is the department's analysis of who actually bears the burden of all of the different taxes. That's an important document. Secondly, there's also a tax expenditure budget, which I have it in a three-ring binder, but it looks like this, again, also on the department's website, that chronicles sort of how much revenue we don't collect because of deviations from sort of a theoretical correct tax base. There, you can argue about that, but essentially that's a good document to have. The other thing, that this is a very handy book to have. There's a new one of these that's out, but the hard copies won't be available, I think, Linda, for another 4 weeks or so. I have, if any of you want, the department gave me the leftovers that they have from last year. I've got about a dozen. If anybody wants the 09 versions, I'll give them to you. But this is very useful to have, because it goes through each of the taxes, has sort of a little bit of the history, how they work, and collections, and so it's also very good. The other thing is, on our website and on the Fiscal Analysis Department website, we have a lot of information, publications, short subjects, and so forth, so you should use that as a resource With that, I'll turn it over to Cynthia and Nina, who are going to start. Cynthia will go over sort of the overall revenue picture, and then the two of them will go into the individual income tax, and then we'll move on to sales and so forth. And we hope to sort of get the state taxes stuff done today.
Ms. Templin. Representative Erickson.
Oh, no, I was just raising my hand to get one of these.
I thought you were just waving. Okay. Yeah, if anybody'd like a booklet, just raise your hand and I won't call on you. And so we have Ms. Templin and Ms. Manzi. Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, again, I'm Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. And before you, to start this presentation, moving to slide 2, you see state tax revenues. And this slide shows at the 20,000-foot level, state tax revenues, the total amount is $17.4 billion in state tax revenues, and this is for fiscal 11. And you can see that the biggest slice of state tax revenues comes from income tax, to nobody's surprise, at $7.3 billion. And sales tax is at the second highest source of state tax revenues at $5.3 billion, or 30.4%. And then all other taxes represent 27.7% of the total, or about $4.8 billion. And again, just to reiterate, this is both general fund and non-general fund tax revenue sources. Moving to the next slide, income tax revenues. As I just said, the income tax revenue total is about $7.3 billion in fiscal 11. And the state also receives payments from Wisconsin for reciprocity, and these payments are roughly $59-60 million. And Commissioner Showalter in MMB just actually informed us that the fiscal 11 payment from Wisconsin has not been received, and that payment is $59 million for fiscal 11. So that is just kind of an interesting sidebar that we just learned about. We, for the biennium, the state is expected to receive about $125 million from Wisconsin for reciprocity. And except for fiscal 11, we're missing the $59 million payment that was due December 1st. I think we'll get into reciprocity later, but basically, for those who do not know what it is, it's basically where it's an arrangement so that individuals that work in one state but reside in another, they only have to fill out one income tax form. And again, income tax revenues represent 42% of state tax revenues, and all income tax revenues are non-dedicated and go to the general fund.
Before moving on, I just want to add, many of you are probably aware that Minnesota's Commissioner of Revenue chose to terminate the reciprocity agreement with the state of Wisconsin last year, and this $59 million payment that we have not yet received is the last scheduled payment from Wisconsin. After this, people who live in one state and work in the other state will be required to file returns in both states.
And Ms. Manzi, which county is most affected by that?
Mr. Chair, I would...
I mean, you got a lot of big counties like Ramsey and Washington, St. Louis.
The county in Minnesota that's probably most affected by it, I would guess, would be one of the counties that you represent, probably Houston County, where there are a number of people who live in your county but may work in the city of La Crosse. In the state of Wisconsin, I would guess it would be the county that's directly across the river that includes the city of Hudson. That's maybe St. Croix County. I'm not sure of my Wisconsin county names.
It's Houston County.
Yeah. Please go on.
Okay. Slide 4 shows 11 years of income tax receipts in constant dollars and actual dollars. And you can see the high point over this 11-year period is in 2008 and a drop in 2010 in income tax receipts. Moving on to slide 5. Slide 5 shows the effective income tax rates, which is the ratio of income taxes paid to income by quintile. This is the same information that is in the
the Department of Revenue's tax incidence report. However, they report the information in deciles, and we just collapsed it into quintiles for presentation purposes. But basically, a quintile is a fifth of the number of households in the state after those households have been ordered and ranked by income. So the fifth quintile is the top 20% of households in income. Let's see what else. As you can see, then, this shows how income tax is a progressive tax. So as you earn more, more taxes are paid. Moving on to the next slide. This shows the income taxes paid, again, by quintile, and it shows the distribution of the burden. And I will move on. Actually, the next slide will, the next series of slides will be covered by Ms. Manzi.
Representative Brownback.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Manzi. Just a question. The income tax rates, I mean, given that the top rate is 7.85, why then? Is that just the blending that gets you to the 5.1% for the top quintile?
Ms.
You're referring
Manzi.
Back to the previous
slide? Previous slide.
Mm-hmm. Previous slide. That's correct. That would the top quintile. Maybe Cynthia can look quickly and see what income level that goes down to in the instance study, or maybe she knows. So that will.
Ms. Manzi.
Representative Rumbach, Mr. Chair. The fifth quintile starts at $86,674 and over.
And that measure is of household income. The tax rates apply to taxable income. And the break point at which the top rate of 7.85% applies is much higher than that starting point for the top 20% of households in the top quintile. So it is, as you suggested, the blending of the bottom rate of 5.35% and then the middle rate of 7.05%. And then, of course, that top quintile does also have everyone who's up in the top rate of 7.85%.
Representative mm-hmm. Brownback?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Okay.
Sure.
Ms. Templin or Manzi, who are...
That's household.
Okay, Ms. Manzi. Before we get going with Ms. Manzi, are there any other members that have not introduced themselves? Representative Rukavina.
Representative Rukavina, hi.
We're glad you're here.
Thank you, Chair.
And you represent a district...
The Iron Range, 5.
The Range, okay.
And how many crazy...
How many square miles do you represent?
A bunch.
A bunch. More than four?
I think I have probably the smallest... Geographic.
The smallest what?
Everything.
Ms. Manzi. Oh, I'm sorry. We another member, a district, and how many parades you have?
Well, that's a little embarrassing. Jennifer Loon from Eden Prairie, District 42B, and I actually have no parades, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to get one, but...
Okay. Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Minnesota's individual income tax, like the income tax of many states, is tied to the federal income tax. That makes it somewhat easier for taxpayers to comply with and easier for the state to administer. We incorporate federal law by reference in our statute, and then one of the benefits of that is that federal tax compliance efforts flow through to the state. So if the IRS finds something strange with someone's return and they go through and check it out, they will pass that information along to the state, and the state can then pursue it and make sure that person's complying with our laws. So I'm going to go back one. We start with federal taxable income, which is federal income after either the standard deduction or itemized deductions and after personal independent exemptions. Then at the state level, we have a number of additions and we have a number of subtractions or deductions. We've tried to streamline this presentation, so I don't have a slide about the additions. There are much fewer additions than there are subtractions. Perhaps the major additions that we have are for the amount of state income tax that was deducted as an itemized deduction at the federal level. Also for the bond interest on bonds issued by other states and municipalities and other states. State and local bond interest is all exempt at the federal level,
Minnesota exempts its own bond interest but taxes the bond interest paid by other states and by municipalities in other states. We also have an addition for the differences between federal and state allowances for Section 179 expensing and for bonus depreciation. Now we have a great many more deductions. I want to talk just a moment about the difference between deductions and credits. A deduction is a subtraction from taxable income or from the base to which the tax is applied. A credit, in contrast, is a subtraction from the tax that's due. So a credit goes against your tax after the rates have been applied to the base, where a deduction simply serves to reduce the amount that's subject to tax. At the state level, we sometimes refer to the deductions as subtractions to differentiate them from the federal deductions. Minnesota has a number of deductions that are required by federal law. We're prohibited from taxing U.S. bond interest, railroad retirement benefits, or on-reservation earnings of members of Indian tribes. Minnesota also has a number of deductions which we have chosen to allow. We have a deduction for K-12 education expenses, a deduction for a portion of charitable contributions that are made by people who do not itemize and who do not at the federal level and who do not claim the federal deduction for charitable contributions, a subtraction for low-income elderly filers. We have a subtraction for most active service military pay, a subtraction for income earned by businesses within Job Z zones, and a subtraction for up to $10,000 of expenses related to organ donation, and that's live organ donation. The K-12 education deduction is probably one of the more well-known of our deductions. There's no income limit for eligibility on it. The maximum deduction is $2,500 for each student that a family has in grades 7 through 12, so secondary students, and then $1,625 per student for grades K through 6. This has the same expenses as our K-12 education credit, and it also is allowed to be claimed for non-public school tuition. So we go through, we start with federal taxable income, put in any additions that you have, take out any state subtractions that you have, and then the measure you get then is called Minnesota taxable income, and to that measure are applied our three rates of 5.35%, 7.05%, and 7.85%. Those have been the rates in effect since tax year 2000. The first rate applies to taxable income for married couples filing jointly up to about $33,000. The second rate goes up to $134,000 roughly, and then any income after that is taxed at a rate of $134,000. There are different rates for the different filing statuses. Single filers and head of household filers, which are single parents, are at lower break points than the married joint filers. Married separate filers, the break points are one-half the amounts shown for married joint filers. So now we've applied the tax rates to the tax, and now we get to the credits. And there are basically two flavors of credits. The non-refundable credit, which can only be used to offset liability. It cannot be used to reduce liability below zero. The first of these is the credit for taxes paid to other states. This one comes into play when a taxpayer has income that's sourced to another state, and so they had to file a tax return in that other state. What they do is they calculate their Minnesota tax on all of their income, including the income that's sourced to the other state, and then they're allowed to claim a credit against that tax equal to the tax that they paid to the other state. This one was about $120 million in tax year 2008. This comes into play for people who own business properties in other states, people who work part of the year in one state and part of the year in another, and then probably most often for people who have either moved into Minnesota during the year or moved out of Minnesota during the year, and so they have to file returns in both of their states of residence for that tax year. We have a marriage penalty credit, which was enacted, I think, in 1999. This offsets the marriage penalty that's inherent in the structure of Minnesota's rates and brackets. I mentioned briefly that the the income breakpoints for the rates for single filers are lower than for married filers. This results in households where both couples have earnings, and generally both couples have roughly equivalent earnings, in a marriage penalty because they end up paying higher taxes if they get married than if they had remained single. What this credit does is it goes through and calculates based on each individual's earned income in a couple what their tax would have been if they had filed as single filers based just on their earned income, and then the credit equals the difference between those figures. This does not apply to unearned income that the two spouses have. At the time it was enacted, the legislature felt that it would be too easy for members of couples to reallocate unearned income in order to maximize their credit and perhaps not truly represent the penalty that they were incurring as a result of getting married. So the credit simply applies to earned income. This credit will equal about $60.5 million in fiscal year 2011. And that all of these credits that I'm going through, the income tax figure of the 7-point-something billion that Cynthia cited, that's after all these credits have been taken into account. The next non-refundable credit is a credit for long-term care expenses equaling 25% of premiums that weren't claimed as a federal itemized deduction. The maximum is $100 per beneficiary, so $400 of premiums. It's about $8 million in fiscal 11. There's a relatively new credit for past military service. It first went into effect in tax year 2009. It's available to military retirees with 20 years of service or who separated from the military due to a disability. The maximum credit is $750, and it's phased out for people with incomes over $30,000. This is estimated at about $1 million in fiscal 11. There is a health insurance credit that's also relatively new. This is for individuals who previously did not have health insurance and are participating in an employer's Section 125 plan. It equals 20% of the first 12 months of premiums that they pay in that plan. It's income limited and tied to the federal poverty guidelines in a way where it was, I think, intended to be available to people who were transitioning from Minnesota care into not having Minnesota care and being in the private market. There were a relatively small number of claimants for this in the first year it was in effect, and it cost just under a million, is projected to cost just under $1 million in fiscal 11. Next, we come to the refundable credits, which are credits which not only offset liability, but then any credit amount in excess of liability is paid to the individuals as a refund. So these are sort of more seen as spending items within the tax committee's purview, whereas the non-refundable credits are more seen as reductions in liability. Principle of these is the working family credit, which is a companion to the federal earned income credit. It's calculated as a percentage of earned income. The maximum credit of almost $1,800 in tax year 11 would apply to households with two or more children. This credit has different rates whether you have no children, one child, or two or more children. It phases out as income increases. The maximum is about $41,000, and again, that's for families with two or more children. There's a lot of people who claim it, about 300,000 people in 2008, and it's close to $200 million in fiscal 11. This is sort of seen as a wage supplement. You have to have earnings to get it. It's a percentage of your earnings up to a maximum amount, and then it enters a plateau level. And then the state credit then has a second phase-in area where it's a percentage of your earnings between a couple of more ranges, around between 15 and 20,000. And then it will start to phase out when your earnings reach around $28,000
or
$29,000.
Mr.
Chair. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wondered if you could, how is that different than the federal working income tax credit? Earned income tax
Ms.
credit?
Ms. Manzi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, the federal credit just has a phase-in range and then a plateau. So the federal credit equals a percentage of the first, and I'm not sure about these figures, but actually, I have them here. So let's just say it equals the percentage of your first $10,000 of earnings, and then your credit will remain flat until your earnings reach, say, $17,000, and then it will phase out. So if you were to make a graph of it, it would look like a flat-topped pyramid, where it would go up as your income increased, and then it would be flat in what's called the plateau, and then it would phase out. In the late 1990s, there was concern in the legislature that a lot of low-income filers were losing benefits from a great many different federal programs at about the same income range. And the programs under consideration included Section 8 housing subsidies, Minnesota Family Assistance Program, the MFIP, the state version of TANF welfare program, the Working Family Credit, the Federal Earned Income Credit, and the Federal and State Dependent Care Credits. And we did some analysis, different groups did some analysis, and discovered that there were some income ranges in which people actually had marginal rates that were approaching or in excess of 100%. So that meant that when they got an increase in their job and they earned another dollar at their job, the loss from the phase-out of the Federal Earned Income Credit, the State Working Family Credit, and their loss of welfare benefits, those things combined would be greater than the $1 of additional income they had gotten at their jobs. So the only tool that the state really had in its toolbox to address that, because we couldn't really change, well, we could change the federal, we could change our MFIP program, but it would be enormously expensive to increase the income level at which it phased out. We couldn't make any changes to the Federal Earned Income Credit, so lawmakers turned to the State Working Family Credit to try to do something about that. And the change that was enacted in 1998 was to change our program from looking like that flat-topped pyramid to looking more like a stepped pyramid. So it goes up, and then it's flat, and then it goes up some more. And that income range where it's going up some more is that income range where the other things are phasing out, so that the increase in the State Working Family Credit is offsetting the loss of the other benefits. And then it is flat, and then it phases out more steeply than the Federal Earned Income Credit phases out, because our maximum income still matches the maximum income eligible for the federal credit, so that we can piggyback on their compliance and eligibility efforts.
Representative Rundeck.
Fine, thank you.
And those income levels,
Manzi.
I have looked up. Okay, so the, let's see, the maximum, the phase-out threshold for the earned income credit is, as I guessed, it's around $17,000. The phase-out threshold for the working family credit is higher than that because of the mechanism I just described. It starts to phase out at about $20,000 if you have one child and $24,000 if you have two or more children.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to the K-12 education credit. The K-12 education credit is also refundable. It offsets 75% of eligible K-12 expenses up to a maximum of $1,000 per child. It does not apply to tuition. So that's the difference between it and the subtraction. It's subject to an income-based phase-out that starts when household income equals $33,500. Where it actually will phase out would depend on the number of children you're claiming it for, because it extends over an additional $2,000 of income for each additional child. About 54,000 households claimed this in 2008, and the total cost in fiscal 11 is estimated at $13.4 million. Next is the dependent care credit. This is tied to the federal dependent care credit, and it's based on expenses of child care for people who are working. The maximum credit is $1,440 for households with two or more children in child care. It also phases out as income increases. The phase out starts so somewhere in the 20,000s of income, and it is fully phased out when income reaches $37,370 in tax year 11. That phase-out level is indexed each year for inflation. About 36,000 people claimed it, and it cost the state in foregone revenues and direct refunds paid to people of $14.2 million in fiscal 11. The Job Z credit is a refundable credit for businesses that increase employment in a Job Z zone. It's a 7% rate. It applies to wages paid to an employee over $35,070, but not over $116,880, so you're getting the credit for sort of middle-income jobs. And let's see, you're not allowed to claim the credit if other Minnesota employment of the business was reduced. And if anyone has questions about this, we'll direct them to Mr. Michael. Military service credit, this is sometimes called the combat zone credit or combat pay credit. This one equals $120 for each month that an individual serves in a combat zone. This is roughly equivalent to a bonus, but the difference between this and a bonus is that historically bonuses for members of the military were paid after a period of conflict was considered to be over. And with the conflicts that we've been involved in since September 11th, they've been perceived more as ongoing, so Minnesota enacted this credit as a way to pay an equivalent of a bonus to people as things went on. Surviving spouses or dependent children may claim the credit for individuals who are killed in a combat zone. Currently, there are about 3,000 Minnesotans claiming this credit per year at just under $2 million in fiscal 11. We have a credit for people's cattle owners' costs of dealing with bovine tuberculosis. The cost of this credit fluctuates depending on how widespread bovine tuberculosis is in the state. It's generally confined to an area in the northwestern part of the state, and it's sort of down right now, but this can go up higher if there's an outbreak. We have two new credits that were enacted last year. One is the Angel Investment Credit. This equals 25% of investment in qualifying small businesses. They must be certified by deed as engaged in one of several fields generally involving technology or the development of technology. They must be located in Minnesota. This credit has a fixed amount per year, so investors must apply to the deed to get a certificate after they make their investment in a qualifying business. The amount is capped at, I think, $11 million in tax year 11 and $12 million in tax year 12. The fiscal year 11 cost of $17 million is a little bit higher than what successive fiscal years will be because the first year has all of tax year 11 in it and then half of tax year 12. So that's why that $17 million looks longer, bigger than the $11 or $12 million per year that some of you may have heard when the credit was enacted. At the same time, this was part of what was called the Jobs Bill last year. Minnesota also enacted a historic structure rehabilitation credit, which is also available as a grant. This credit matches 20%, the 20% federal historic credit. So somebody who's rehabilitating a historic building and the rehabilitation plan has been reviewed and approved by the Historical Society, they will get a federal credit equal to 20% of their costs and a state credit equal to another 20% of their costs. The state credit is claimed after the building has been rehabilitated and placed in service. It's estimated to equal $1.2 million in fiscal 11 in credits and grants. Someone may choose the grant option. The grant is limited to 90% of the credit amount they would otherwise be eligible for, but that it's sometimes a little easier for them to administer, and so far about half of the applicants have chosen the grant and about half have chosen the credit, or actually half of the dollar amounts. I'm not sure how that breaks out by project, but of that $1.2 million, about half of it is estimated in grants and half in credits. The research credit, this is new for the individual income tax. It's been allowed for quite a long time for the corporate tax. It was extended to the individual tax, S-corporation partnerships, and LLC owners in the Jobs Bill last year. It's based on a similar federal credit, equals 10% of the first $2 million of qualifying research expenses and then 2.5% of any excess increase in research expenditures. It's projected to equal $1.1 million in fiscal 11. This is the portion that's under the individual income tax only, and Mr. Michael may reference the corporate tax portion later when we talk about corporate taxes. And that's all for the income tax, so if anyone has any closing questions, this is the time.
Any questions for Ms. Manzi or Ms. Templin? If not, we will proceed. And in the meantime, we have another member that has joined us. Representative Groffel, could you introduce yourself and how many parades you have in your district?
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Pat Groffel. I'm in my fourth term. Represent Farmington, Lakeville, and portions of rural Dakota and Goodhue County. My job on this committee will be to bother, cajole, and annoy the DFL minority, just like I did last term. So, but it's a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chairman. I have five parades in my district.
Five parades, okay. A couple other things before we continue here. When it comes to all members, if you have some folks from your districts that are coming to testify before the tax committee, if you could give us the heads up rather than just have them come down here and sit out there and we can't get to them. One of the rules that isn't listed here that we kind of have rules as we go along, but one thing I've always followed, if you have somebody that has driven more than 50 miles, and even if they're like, I kind of categorize people as real people, those would be those people living over 50 miles from the Capitol that have real jobs in real life that are here because they took some time off and actually need to get on the docket. I want to accommodate them best we can, even if it's out of order at some point. So if somebody comes from Representative Coonan's district or Marquardt's or whoever that's over 50 miles from the Capitol, we want to get them on that day, even if we haven't kind of gotten to their turn yet. The roadies and groupies that we have will be that are here. That definition of people are those folks that are like here all the time, getting paid to be here. We will, of course, treat you with respect and so forth. But I'm really concerned about if somebody comes down from Virginia, we better get them on the docket that day because they have real lives and have real jobs that they need to get back to. So that's the 50-mile rule. And the other thing for some members that just got here, we will start on time every day, period. I've started meetings with my car keys before because I didn't have the gavel here. We will start on time. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just respectfully request that you give some consideration to real people who live within 50 miles who might have taken time off of work to also inform us who aren't registered as lobbyists.
And Representative Loeffler, actually the 50, I misspoke, the 50-mile rule doesn't apply to real people. We will, but the real people, the real people that are over 50 miles will take some precedence just for the fact that the real people under 50 miles are under 50 miles. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I'm just looking, you know, I've been on tax committee for many, 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 many years, and I don't recall us ever having any rules here. And is there a 50-second rule on amendments since there's a 50-mile rule?
I think I heard a little bit late. Representative Lincheski and I will be discussing rules after committee. We're gonna go through the rules at the next meeting.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, Mr. Chair, I did notice that you've lost a considerable amount of weight. You look great. And I thought you were just getting ready, you know, in fighting condition to take me on this session. So I hope you don't wimp out on us and make some rules that we never imposed on you. That's all.
Representative Rukavina, I would suggest that it's good for folks to lose weight, but probably not to take the David's weight loss plan and my approach to it. But we will have a robust discussion. And basically, if you look at them, it's not like we got 80 rules. It's a few things to try and get some committee amendments flowing smoothly. And Representative Lincheski and I will have those discussions. And we will bring our results of our discussions to the meeting on Thursday. Representative Rukavina?
Yeah, I am.
Okay.
Representative Rukavina.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Ms. Manzi. So altogether, what do we spend in refundable credits approximately?
Ms. Manzi?
Mm-hmm. Just a moment. Yeah, those are. David.
Ms. Manzi, to the Erickson question,
Mr. Chair, I can add them too if that's what she's going to do. I thought she had some figure at the tip of her tongue. No, I can add them. It's not a problem.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, it's between $230 and $240 million. I would like to point out that not all of that amount is paid as refunds. Part of it offsets liability for some of the credits, for the K-12 credit, the dependent care credit, and the working family credit. I can provide you with a breakout of how much of it is a refund and how much of it is offsetting liability. I don't have that figure with me, but I'll be happy to provide that to you.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Okay, could you provide that to the whole committee?
Yes.
Sure. Representative Rukavina.
To that point, does that number you just threw out there include the job seat?
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I intended to add that one in there, and I maybe didn't, I maybe did. I will include the total amount of the refundable credits in the information I provide to the committee. I don't have data for all of them on how much is paid as a refund and how much offsets liability. I know that I do for the three credits that I cited.
Representative Rukavina? Okay, any other questions for Ms. Manley? Ms. Manzi? Ms. Manzi? Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Dalton, are you going to be presenting sales tax? You know, somebody said that listening to House Research was like watching paint dry. These are page turners here. I mean, if this isn't exciting, I don't know what is. You know?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, I believe the last person to actually say that was you to me as I was setting this up.
Oh, okay. No, I said more like eating broken glass, I think it was. But with that being said, Ms. Dalton, or Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair, I will just cover the general summaries of sales tax and revenues and incidents. Starting on page 29, sales tax revenue equals $5.3 billion for fiscal 2011, and that is roughly a third of total state tax revenues. And again, this is general fund and non-general fund. And businesses pay roughly about 45% of this tax. And then just as a kind of general rule of thumb, about 1% of sales tax equals about $670 million. Moving to the next slide, slide 30. This slide, again, shows 11 years of revenue. And it shows that in actual dollars and constant dollars, and you can see there's, over this 11-year span, there's just a general slight, you know, increase in sales tax revenue or upward trend till about 2008, where there's a slight dip in sales tax revenues. And back in 2011, the upward trend in sales tax revenue starts to uptick in that year. On slide 31, this shows, again, the same information in the tax incidence report published by the Department of Revenue. This shows the effective sales tax rates, and this is, again, the ratio of sales taxes paid to income. And this slide shows, again, the population grouped in quintiles. So the first quintile is the population with the low, or 20% of the lowest income. And for sales tax, you can see that this is a regressive tax because the lowest income pay more relative to their income. The next slide is the percent of tax paid, and this shows the burden of total taxes paid by income. And you can see the top 20% of households with the highest income pay 44.7% of the total.
Excuse me, Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Templin, I always find it instructive to understand what the income breaks are for the different quintiles.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you have that information.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Thank you, Mr.
Dabney,
Chair, Ms.
in your big packet on page, on the sales tax section, there is a chart. Let me find that. And it shows the incomes.
Page 21.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, page 21 shows the income range by quintile.
Representative Dabney?
Yes, just thank you, Mr. Chair. Clarification, are these household rates, individual, how? When Ms. Manzi was up there was some use of both of those measures? Can you just help me to understand?
The definition of the deciles that is in the tax incidence report is, they say it's the households in the state after those households have been ordered and ranked by income. So it's the households.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Duncan.
Ms. Templin?
That concludes the kind of overview of sales tax revenues and incidents, and Ms. Dalton will cover the rest.
Ms. Dalton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton with House Research. First, I'm going to talk about the distribution of sales tax. A little less than 90% of the local sales taxes goes to the general fund, with the remaining 10% dedicated. There are four major parts of dedication: the motor vehicle sales tax, the tax on motor vehicle leases, lottery in lieu, and the legacy amendment, the revenue from the legacy amendment, which increased the state rate by 3.75%. Two of those dedications are constitutional dedications. The motor vehicle sales tax dedication passed in the 2006 election. It's phasing in the dedication of that tax. About 60%, beginning in fiscal year 2012, 60% of that tax is going to go to the Highway User Trust Distribution Fund, and the remaining 40% is going to stay in the general fund, but in transit funds within the general fund. 36% of it to transit in the metropolitan area, and 4% of it to the Greater Minnesota Transit Fund. The tax on motor vehicle leases, that's a statutory dedication, and motor vehicle leases are subject to the sales tax, not to the motor vehicle sales tax, which are two different chapters of law. The motor vehicle sales tax dedication, lease dedication was a statutory dedication. It's supposed to be phased in at the same schedule as the motor vehicle sales tax dedication. Its money, 50% is supposed to go to the Greater Minnesota Transit, and 50% is supposed to go to county state aid for metro counties except for Hennepin and Ramsey. And the money within the metro counties is divided based on population. Not all of the revenues from those leases is supposed to go to these dedications. It is originally, when it was set up, it was supposed to be the revenue net of the revenue it was going to take to fund a low-income fuels tax credit. That tax credit has since been repealed. However, we are maintaining or retaining about $30 million in the revenues from these leases in the general fund, and only the net amount is being sent to these dedicated things. We can do that because it's, as I said, it's statutorily dedicated, it's not constitutionally dedicated. There's no money currently going from leases into these dedicated funds. The first year that we're estimating that will happen will be in 2013, and that will be about $1.8 million split between those two funds. Lottery in lieu payments is the other statutory dedication. Just under 73% of that money is dedicated to essentially natural resource funds. 50% of it goes to the Heritage Enhancement Account, and 50% of it goes to the Natural Resource Fund, of that 73%. And of the 50% going to the Natural Resource Fund, 2% of that is dedicated to zoos. And as I said, the other big one is the revenue from the Legacy Amendment, and this is our newest one, so we'll talk about it a little bit. This one was passed as part of the 2008 election. It basically increased the state rate from 6.5% to 6.875% for the next 20 years. It was effective July 1, 29. And it is constitutionally dedicated. The revenue is about $250 million a year, and it is split one-third to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, one-third to the Clean Water Fund, and the remaining one-third is split between the Parks and Trails Fund and the Arts and Heritage Culture Fund. To give you an idea of the money, there is actually a table of the actual dollar amounts on page 24 in the larger handout. but it's roughly $82 million each to the Outdoor Heritage and Clean Water Fund, $36 million to the Parks and Trails Fund, and $49 million to the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund in fiscal year 2011. As we said, the general sales tax rate, at least until 2029, is 6.875%. That was the first increase in the sales tax rate since 1991. In 1991, the legislature enacted what was called the local option sales tax, which was not very optional. Basically, a county who didn't pass it was going to not only lose all of their state aid, but all of the local governments within that county would lose all of their state aid as well. Needless to say, all 87 counties passed that local option tax, and it officially became part of the state tax in 1994.
Ms. Dalton, isn't that a temporary tax?
Mr. Chair, no, that's a permanent tax.
Oh, that one is. When we passed, I know it was temporary in 91. That was my first year.
Mr. Chair, as I said, it was called a lot of things, including optional, and most of those things did not actually end up happening. We have a couple of special rates. We impose a number of additional taxes on short-term rental motor vehicles. So we have a motor vehicle rental rate of 13.075%. Manufactured housing and park trailers are taxed on only 65% of their costs, so it's subject to the 6.875% tax, but only on 65% of the costs. Motor vehicle sales tax, as I said, is in a separate chapter of law. It's in Chapter 297B. The general tax is in 297A. The constitutional amendment, the legacy amendment, only applied to what was taxed under the general law. So the motor vehicle sales tax remains at the 6.5%. Unlike the motor vehicle leases, which are taxed at the under the general law, so they're at 6.875. So there's actually, you pay a different tax depending on whether you buy a car or whether you have a long-term lease on a car. One of those interesting little things about our tax. Minnesota has a relatively high state tax. There's only six states in the country who have a higher rate: California, Indiana, Mississippi, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Tennessee. Having said that, many states impose a number of local sales taxes, and even though we're getting to have more and more local sales taxes, we do not come anywhere close to some of the local sales taxes in other states. There are at least 15 states who have higher maximum combined state and local tax rates compared to our highest combined state and local tax rate. And our combined highest state and local tax rate is 7.875%, which exists in Duluth and Cook County. People often think it's got to be Minneapolis because we have so many local taxes. We have the Twins tax, the Minneapolis tax, and the Hennepin County Transit tax that all apply in Minneapolis, but their combined rate is only 7.775%. It's a tenth of a percent lower than the rate in Duluth and Cook. Sales tax base. In theory, the sales tax is a tax on final consumption, but in reality, that's not really how it works. It's really, much of final consumption in this state is exempt, and many intermediate business inputs are taxed. 45% of the sales tax revenues collected in this state are paid by businesses. Minnesota has a relatively narrow tax base, mainly because we do not tax food and we do not tax clothing. We also don't tax a number of services. Generally speaking, though, when you think about the sales tax, it's good to think about goods. Tangible things are usually taxable unless specifically exempted from the law, and services and intangibles, such as digital downloads, are not taxable unless they are specifically included in the law. As I said, Minnesota has a fairly narrow tax base. and it's because of some of our exemptions. Food for home consumption, clothing, and home heating fuels are very large exemptions. They've been exempt for the entire length of the sales tax, and they've been exempted because they are considered to be necessities. Some of the other big exemptions, motor fuels are not subject to the sales tax, but they are subject to the gas tax instead. All drugs for human consumption are exempted. Prior to 2006, from the period from 1987 to 2006, we actually did tax non-prescription drugs except for painkillers like aspirin. And for something we'll talk about a little bit later, to get into compliance with something called the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement, we either had to start taxing aspirin or we had to exempt all of the non-prescription drugs, and the legislature chose to do the broader exemption. Newspapers and subscription magazines are exempt, and cigarettes were made exempt in 2005, but that's because they are now subject to a separate tax based on their average price, because that tax is not part of the general sales tax. Again, that tax is only imposed at a 6.5% rate. It did not go up automatically with the imposition of the legacy tax. Since the 80s, the state has been slowly moving to try to exempt business inputs.
Excuse me.
The big one, of course, everyone's aware of is the capital equipment exemption for manufacturing. Originally, that exemption was only allowed for certain businesses on essentially new equipment, and it was at a reduced rate. And because of that, the tax was historically collected, and then the businesses that qualified applied for a refund. As that capital equipment exemption has been expanded to all manufacturing, it's gotten broader, but we haven't eliminated the refund requirement. And so I'm sure you've all heard that this is, you know, one of the things that businesses often have a problem with, that they have to pay that tax up front and then apply for a refund. And there's a lot of paperwork in applying for that refund. We have also exempted direct inputs to agricultural and industrial production, items that are consumed in the production process. And most recently, we have exempted direct inputs for certain taxable services. And page 28 of the larger handout actually has a list of those business exemptions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Dalton, do you have any information as to how Minnesota's, how we treat capital equipment? I mean, is that very similar to many, many other states, or where do we lie in the mix?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, a number of states have been moving towards either exempt capital equipment or have been moving towards exempting capital equipment. We are not uncommon in that. I don't have an actual number. I can actually find that number for the committee and get it to you on what other states exempt capital equipment. We're probably one of the few that actually does it as a refund mechanism. And for the interest of the committee, the last time it was proposed, I believe it was about $200 million of upfront one-time cost to switch from a refund to an upfront exemption, with an additional about $10 million a year in costs, just because of moving things from different fiscal years.
Representative Runbeck?
Mm-hmm. That's fine. Thank you, Mr.
Ms. Dalton?
Other major sales tax exemptions. Sales to schools, the federal government, public libraries, and hospitals. Selected sales to other local governments. We began taxing sales to most local governments, cities, counties, towns, special taxing districts in 1991. This often is an issue, so it's good to give you a little background on it. The inclusion of them in the tax base in 1991 was a legislative trade-off. The local governments were given the option of having their aids cut yet again, because 1991 was a year of a budget crisis, or having the sales tax imposed on them. And through the negotiations, the decision was made to impose the sales tax.
I would add to that, Ms. Dalton, when your cities and townships and counties come at you saying, why do you do this, you say, well, your groups wanted this in 1991. And wasn't it about $793 million they'd lose in LGAs if they didn't agree to this?
Mr. Chair, I would have to actually go back and see how much money they thought that the cut was going to be if they hadn't agreed to this.
But they really fought for this to
this was a negotiated agreement between the local governments. Taxing local governments has kind of been chipped away at over the years. We now exempt things like firefighter equipment and library purchases and trucks use gravel for township roads. So I mean, there has been chipping away at taxing local government purchases for a number of years. The other thing, as I said, we don't tax sales to certain nonprofit charitable organizations. Not all nonprofit charitable organizations get this exemption. It has to be for religious, educational, charitable benefits. We also have some benefits, some exemptions for purchases by groups that serve senior citizens. And then we exempt sales made by certain nonprofits, the Boy Scouts, school athletic booster clubs, and things like that. As I said, sales tax base in this state is narrow, and it is growing at a rate that is slower than the economy as a whole. So it is getting narrower. There's a couple of things that are causing this. One is that the economy has been moving to a service economy, and we don't tax the number of services. In 1965, 42% of personal consumption was services. In 2009, two-thirds of personal consumption expenditures are services. So as we move more and more into a service economy, there's less and less personal consumption that we're actually subjecting to the sales tax. The other thing that is having an impact on our sales tax base is remote sales. Nobody is shocked to hear that the internet, sales over the internet, is a growing part of retail sales in this country. The state cannot constitutionally impose a duty to collect sales tax on remote sellers. That means catalog sellers and internet sellers. That does not mean that the tax isn't owed. Minnesota is a state that imposes a sales and use tax. If you are making purchases that where the seller does not collect the sales tax, you owe a use tax in this state. There is a de minimis for individuals making purchases that are not subject, that are not having the sales tax collected on it, and that is for if you're catalog and internet sales are less than purchases are less than $770 a year, you don't have to pay the use tax. But above that amount, you in theory owe use tax on all of that tax. The reality is we have no way of collecting it, and we can't make those people collect it. This is a result of court cases that basically say making sellers collect a state sales tax imposes an undue burden on interstate commerce. Congress could change this. Congress could impose a duty to collect, has not done so. There have been bills introduced in Congress several times over the last 10 years, and Congress has not acted on any of them. State revenue losses from retail remote sales is estimated to be $204 million. That does not count the estimated use tax losses on business purchases, where we are not collecting it, again, because of remote sales on business purchases. A number of states have been trying to reduce the burden, the undue burden on interstate commerce, and therefore overturn the court cases or bring another court case to have Supreme Court say we can impose this duty to collect, or conversely, have Congress impose the duty to collect. And the main way they've done it is through what's called the Streamlined Sales and Use Tax Agreement. Minnesota was one of the founding states of the group that developed this agreement. It's an agreement to simplify and standardize tax administration and collection between the states. One of the big components of this agreement is standard definitions of items that can or cannot be subject to tax. It doesn't tell us what we can tax or what we can't tax, but it says if you're going to tax certain goods, you have to define them in certain ways. Minnesota is one of 20 full members of the SSUTA. There are four associate members. The associate members are states who have basically passed all the legislation to be in compliance with the agreement, but that legislation won't be effective for another 12 months. Since joining this agreement, Minnesota has collected $87.4 million voluntarily. There are some amnesty provisions in this agreement and some joint registration agreements in this provision. Some states have registered voluntarily individually under those amnesty provisions. Some have registered through, some businesses have registered in the state through the joint registration of SSUTA, and this is the amount that they've collected under those voluntary registrations in the last not quite 5 years. One of the things that happens in Streamline is that each state who is a member state undergoes a compliance review every year, and we are found whether we are in compliance or out of compliance. Minnesota was found out of compliance in September. If you were on this tax committee last year, this shouldn't be a surprise because this was actually talked about at that time. Minnesota taxes ringtones as part of its taxation of telecommunication services. The SSUTA agreement requires that ringtones be defined as digital audio downloads, and we don't tax the rest of the digital audio downloads. This would be primarily iTunes.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Dalton, back to the previous slide, you estimated that $204 million was lost to retail remote sales. Is that a gross number, or is that net of what we then collect under voluntary use tax collections? How's that number arrived at?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I believe that is a net number, and it is based on the non-collections that were going on at the time that the estimate was made.
Representative Downey. Thank you, Ms. Dalton.
The sanctions for being out of compliance, we don't know what they are. We are waiting to hear what those sanctions could be. They could be anything from, they could be as mild as we can't be a voting member, we can't vote on changes to the agreement until we are brought into compliance. Or they can be as high as we can no longer collect from these voluntary payers, and we cannot use the fact that they voluntarily registered to go after them for future collections. We don't know what
Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton, how much do we collect in the ringtones revenue?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, Cynthia and I were thinking it's just a couple of million dollars. It's something under $5 million now.
Representative Anderson? Ms. Dalton?
And then finally, we're going to finish with the local sales taxes, which may actually be under the purview of the property tax division, where it has been in the past. It's kind of up to the division chair and the chair of this committee to decide where it is, but it's good for you guys to know what they are. In 1971, as part of the Minnesota Miracle, the state reformed and expanded state aids to local governments, but at the same time, they prohibited local governments from imposing sales and income taxes. There was only one city at the time that had a local sales tax, and that was the city of Duluth. All the rest of the local sales taxes in this state have been imposed since then, and they've been imposed under special law. There were only 5 local sales taxes by 1993. There were 10 by 2000. And as you can see, currently 23 cities in the state currently impose a general local sales tax, and there are 6 counties that impose a local sales tax. Duluth and Cook County impose a tax of 1%. Everybody else's rates, except for the county rates, which we'll talk about in a minute, are imposed at a 5% rate. Hennepin County imposes a tax of 0.15% for the ballpark. All of these local taxes, with the exception of the Duluth tax and the transit taxes, which I'll talk about, are required to expire. Duluth is also the only city that can use its local sales tax for general purposes. Virtually all of the other local sales taxes are tied to funding bricks and mortar type projects. In 2008, there were 2 new transportation local sales taxes authorized by the legislature. One was a 0.25% transit tax, which was could be imposed in any of the 7 counties in the metro area. 5 of them imposed it: Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington. That tax does not expire. The 2 remaining metro counties may impose a transit tax in the future, and all they have to do is pass a resolution saying that they want to impose the tax. However, they could choose never to impose that tax, and they could impose a 0.5% tax for transportation purposes. All the counties in Greater Minnesota and those 2 counties could impose a 0.5% sales tax for transportation purposes. However, they are required to get voter approval, and that tax has to expire when that project is done. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Michael to talk about corporate taxes.
Mr. Michael. Any questions for Ms. Dalton? But make sure you have their numbers, because they're invaluable, what they can help you with. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the good news is you're through 72% of state revenues. I'll try to get through the remaining 28% and the half a dozen small taxes in the last 20 minutes of the committee meeting. Corporate franchise tax, or what most people talk about as the corporate income tax, is the largest of those other taxes. The tax base for that tax is largely the profits of C corporations. Obviously, Minnesota can't tax the national profits of these multi-state companies, so there has to be a mechanism that determines the Minnesota share of their profits. That's done with a 3-factor apportionment formula that's based on property, payroll, and sales. So I suspect most of you know that we're moving to the point where it will only be based on sales. Right now it's 90% sales, 5% property, and 5% payroll. The tax rate is 9.8%. Credits against the tax. When Nina went through the individual income tax, she talked about the research credit, which has been a long-standing corporate credit since 1983. This last year it was extended to individuals. It has a minimal cost for individuals, but a fairly substantial cost for corporations. It's about over $20 million a year, whereas the individual side was about $1 million. There's a credit for taxes paid to other states when income is allocated rather than apportioned. Then there's a chance for double taxation, and Minnesota is one of the very few states that has this credit that abates that. There's the JobZ credit for hiring employees in JobZ zones. That's a relatively small amount, about $1 million. And also last year in the jobs bill, the historic structured credit was enacted that also can be claimed by corporations, and the numbers that Nina gave you for that include the corporate cost of that. Now, the one exception to the tax base being profits is that there's a minimum fee that applies, and this applies, most corporate tax only applies to what are called C corporations, which are organized under a chapter of the Internal Revenue Code. Corporations that are organized under Chapter S, or businesses that are organized as LLCs or partnerships, pay tax under the individual income tax, with the exception that there's this minimum fee that applies that scaled from either $100 to $5,000, depending upon the size of the business. Corporate tax raises about $1 billion for fiscal 11. The thing that's interesting about revenues from the corporate tax is it's unbelievably volatile. It's like a roller coaster. In the slide, you can see how it's varied. It's been as low in the last decade as a little over $500 million to as much as $1.2 million. And, you know, drop from 07 to 2010, that's about a 43% drop. And that largely is due to the fact that profits of corporations fluctuate a lot from year to year. So it's sort of an unreliable source of revenue from that perspective. Another important thing is the single sales apportionment. In effect, when we get to 100% sales, this really, I mean, economists, when they talk about this tax, say really it's more like it's the apportionment factors are really what determines what the tax is on. And so it's really important to think about that. And that's why we're going to 100% sales, because it, in effect, makes it like a de facto sales tax that applies to corporations that have profits. So if you don't, if you're making stuff in Minnesota and you're selling it outside Minnesota, you really won't have any corporate tax applied to you once we get to single sales, because all of those sales will apportion, those out of Minnesota sales will apportion your income outside Minnesota for purposes of our tax calculations. And that's obviously why the state went to this 100% sales, and why a lot of other states have done that too. In the larger packet, there's a map where you can see how other states have done that, and all of our surrounding states that have corporate taxes, like Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska, Illinois, they all have 100% sales apportionment. But there's another little factor that's important. Some of them, like Wisconsin and Illinois, have throwback rules, and that those throwback rules undercut the 100% sales apportionment. A throwback rule says if you're selling to a state other than Minnesota, but you don't have presence in that state, so you have to pay tax in that state, a throwback rule says we're going to count that as our own sale. Like in Minnesota, if we had a throwback rule, that would treat that sale as a Minnesota sale. Wisconsin has a rule like that. Illinois has a rule like that. Minnesota does not. The reason why that undercuts single sales is if you have a small business that doesn't have nexus in those other states, suddenly they would have Minnesota sales and would pay tax when they're really selling these goods in the other state. So even though Wisconsin is 100% sales state, they're not as competitive as we would be once we get to 100% sales, because they have a throwback rule. This just shows the incidence study, which shows that the corporate tax is a regressive tax, because economists conclude that a lot of it gets passed back to consumers and to the workers for the businesses, and it's not borne by the owners of the stock. Turning to the motor vehicle fuels tax, the gas tax, tax base is again the, you know, purchases of gasoline and diesel fuel.
Excuse me, Mr. Michael, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Michael, if the corporate franchise tax is regressive because companies just pass the costs on to consumers, can I argue that taxes on me are bad because I just pass the costs on to my employer in the form of demanding higher wages?
Mr. Michael?
Careful, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lesh. In fact, there is an argument about that, and I think it's one of the reasons why employers are concerned. Normally you would think, hey, an employer is not concerned about the individual income tax because that tax is imposed on its employees. And so therefore, why do they care? Well, they do care to a certain extent, because to the extent that labor is mobile and moves from state to state, and they have to attract, and one of the things that they're forced to do is to attract good skilled labor, because that's the way they succeed as a business. And if in fact, you know, one state has a much higher income tax than another state, the only way they can attract labor from a national pool would be to raise compensation to offset the fact that you have a higher income tax. So there's some economic theory that would in fact suggest that what you're saying is true. And I think if you take, you know, sort of a simplified example of that, you think about, say, professional sports teams who are negotiating with free agents. And if you have a sports team that's located in a state that has no income tax and one that does, this actually has come up, and economists have talked about it in the context of, you know, the recent signing of, well, there was a bidding war between the Texas Rangers and the Philadelphia Phillies and the New York Yankees for, I forget the name of the left-hander now, that ultimately signed with the Phillies. And there were calculations made that the Rangers were able to bid less and argued to him that their price was the same as the Yankees. He ultimately signed with the Phillies. Philadelphia has a local tax, but Pennsylvania has a state tax that's sort of on the low side compared certainly with New York City. But it is, taxes on individual income is a factor in for businesses too. But in general, the Department of Revenue on the corporate franchise tax assumes that a portion of it's paid by capital. I think it's about 49% or something like that. And most of that gets exported because stock is held nationally, you know, so like the shares of 3M and so forth. But that's sort of a long, rambling discussion of the issues that are involved.
Representative, wasn't it also in the LeBron James signing in Orlando? Or Miami? Thank you. Versus, who was it? Who else was in that?
Cleveland.
Okay. Representative Lesh, I'm sorry.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So, Mr. Michael, your response made me think of another question. So these municipalities, the cities that have local income taxes, they do that because they get a bite at the apple for these players who play in a stadium in the municipality, because it has to be declared there as the location of work versus if they live in the suburbs. Is that correct?
Mr. Mike?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, that is correct for those handful of places that have local income taxes, that usually it's based on where both they, sort of similar to what the state does, they tax their residents. So if you live in Philadelphia and work in Valley Forge or something like that, you would pay the Philadelphia tax. But if you live in Valley Forge and work in Philadelphia, you would also pay it. And it's, those do not apply just to sports figures. They apply to all workers.
Representative Lesh? Okay, Mr. Michael?
So moving on to the gas tax, motor vehicle fuels tax, the tax rates, currently 25%. There's an additional debt service charge that I believe is set at 3 cents now. It's going to hit a maximum of 3.5 cents in 2013 and later. The revenues from this obviously go to the Highway User Trust Fund, and the local governments receive a share of that through the county state aid and the municipal state aid money. The revenue from this for 11 is 2011. Cigarette excise tax. The thing to note about all three of these excise taxes is they're set as dollar amounts per unit. And so unlike the income or the sales tax, which are a percentage of your income or a percentage of the sale price, as prices change with inflation, these taxes do not change. So they decline in real terms over time. Cigarette tax, we've got the regular tax rate of 48 cents, and then the additional health impact fee of 75 cents for other tobacco products, so like cigars and snuff and chewing tobacco and so forth. The tax is 70% of the wholesale price when you combine the two. And the longer handout has comparisons for most of these taxes with what other states do. Cigarette and tobacco tax raises a little over $400 million for fiscal 11. $31 million of that's dedicated to health research, most of it over at the university. There's also a small fee that's imposed on non-settling cigarettes. So these are cigarettes that are produced not by the major companies that were sued and settled, but they're sort of new entrant companies, and that essentially, I think the settlement cost is close to 50 cents a pack, so this is, you know, a fraction of that, and it sort of prevents cheap cigarettes from, you know, gaining a large market share. Florida, which does not have a fee like this, has now, and is similar to Minnesota in that it was not part of the master settlement, has a very large share of their cigarette market that's covered by these kinds of companies. They're interested actually in pursuing Minnesota's approach to this because they've found that a lot of these new entrants are, I think that it's like 10 or 20%, somewhere in that range of their market. On the alcoholic beverage excise taxes, again, these are a per unit, a dollar amount per unit. Tax rates vary by the beverage type, the highest for liquor, lowest for wine on a relative basis. Minnesota's beer and wine tax are relatively low on a national comparison. Taxes unrelated to alcoholic content, so you can have high alcohol liquor and low alcohol liquor that pays the same. The revenue from the excise tax is about $77 million. In addition to this excise tax that's imposed at the manufacturer, the distributor level, we also have a gross receipts tax that's collected at the retail level. It used to be that this was just a different rate under the sales tax. The streamlined sales tax doesn't allow us to do this, so we made it a separate tax. This raises almost as much as the excise tax that's collected at the distributor level. These two graphs show that these taxes are regressive, obviously. Motor vehicle license fee.
Hey, Mr. Michael, I think what we're going to do is we will pick up at this point. If you want to mark that there, okay. We'll start out with motor vehicle licenses on Thursday. Then we'll have a discussion of some rules, and we've got some other agenda items. So, members, if you could put in your safe packet those things that you wish to keep. Otherwise, the pages will probably be recycling those. So, with that, we are adjourned till Thursday. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.